Welcome, everyone, to the February edition of the Football Scholars Forum. Today, we're joined by Joshua Nadel on his book, Football, Why Soccer Matters in Latin America. Josh is an assistant professor of history and associate director of the Global Studies Program at North Carolina Central University. And as customary, we'll invite Josh now just to give us a little bit of sense of writing this book, getting it published, and any fun stories about it. Josh?
Sure. Hi, everybody. I hope everyone's well, not overheating or freezing, as the case may be. So I guess, you know, this book has sort of a strange lifespan, I guess, a strange start story, because it's not my original research. It didn't stem out of my dissertation or anything like that. It's something that... Can people hear me, by the way?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. It's something that that actually the press asked me to do. And there's sort of a long history that I don't fully understand, a backstory that I don't fully understand. But in 2008, I was contacted by Michael Francis, who's a colonial Latin Americanist, who had been on a search committee who'd been the chair of the search committee for a job that I was a finalist for. And he sort of called and said, hey, you know, I'm now on the board of the press of University Press of Florida. And we're looking to do a book on soccer. And do you know anyone who could do it? And could you do it? Or could you do it? And my first response actually was to contact Jeff Ritchie, who was, you know, then I think a second or third year grad student at UNC, and ask him whether he felt up to it. And then, since, you know, my dissertation had focused a little bit on recreation and the meaning of recreation and sport in Cuba, I decided that that I could give it a shot. Let's put it that way. And so I, you know, that's sort of the origin story of the book. So I think it's a very strange one. It wasn't one where I had to, you know, I didn't put the proposal together without the knowledge that there was sort of support there already for the project. And that was, I think, a very different reality than most people have. A very different reality than most people have. So from there, it became sort of a very, I guess, a steep learning process for me, right? Because I sort of tangentially knew about soccer, the literature on soccer, but I was not in any way immersed in it. And so I had this incredibly steep learning curve to sort of even get to the point where I could conceive of how I wanted to write the book. And the press was pretty clear from the get-go that they wanted something that sort of split the difference between a trade volume and something academic. And so that's part of the reason that the book is structured how it is. Part of the reason that it's you know, written in a relatively non-academic style, I guess. Yeah, I mean, the challenge for me was really getting up to speed on the literature, and then I guess really figuring out, you know, I knew sort of what the themes were I wanted to write about, but figuring out sort of, you know, what theme fit with what country or what countries, as the case may be. So that's sort of the birth story in a lot of ways. I'll just leave it there.
Great. Thanks, Josh. Yeah. I'll lead us off with a question here. My first question is about sources. You have a very ambitious design for the book and in the amount of places that you're writing about. What was it like to consult with others on what you already knew was available in terms of sources? Mm-hmm. And how did that break down in terms of getting a look at both the club side of sources talking about clubs and the sources talking about national teams? And I know the kind of the research question that drives the book is allowing you to talk a little bit more about the national teams, but I wonder how much of that was also adapting to the sources.
Yeah, that's a great question. So initially, I sort of conceived the entire project as being just about national teams. And so I sort of targeted those sources first. And as I sort of in the process of again, you know, of the steep learning curve, I sort of came to realize that it couldn't just be about the national teams. Although I think that, you know, that they are still sort of, I talk much more about national teams than club teams. So I sort of nod to the fact that clubs matter, I think, in a way that I could cover a lot more. So, I mean, in terms of that, you know, the most difficult sources to find, or the rarer sources, I guess, I got at the FIFA archives, and also at the AFA archives in Argentina, in Buenos Aires. You know, and I sort of went on these very short trips and essentially took photographs of all of the sort of rare books that I could find about any region, any country in Latin America, actually targeting the seven countries that are focused on in the book. And then I spoke a lot with other people about sort of where to find things and how to find things both in Argentina and in the United States. But for the most part, I think, you know, I was looking more for sources on national team stuff, because that to me was really where it was sort of a calculated choice that I made to focus on that more than on club teams. I'm not sure that it always worked as well as I would have liked it to, quite honestly. But the process of finding sources was quite difficult. I mean, in the case of Honduras, really there are two books written, really one book that has two editions written on Honduran soccer at all. So you know that there are challenges depending on the country, and you know, different challenges based on the country, basically.
Thanks. Yeah. Who would like to ask our next question? How about Daniel? Go ahead.
Josh, maybe you could elaborate a little bit, I mean, the success of Uruguay. I mean, even if you write like there's a decline and, I mean, okay, they won the World Cups earlier, but still there, if one looks at the population size of 3-point-something million, it's remarkable what they achieved with like the fourth rank in 2010. So how do you explain this success among nations which have like 200 million people, like Brazil, 80 million people, Germany, 60 million people, Italy, France? So what are the reasons for the success, and why are they not similar successful in other sports? I checked, for example, in the whole history of the Olympics, they won 10 medals. So this seems to be a soccer-specific thing, the sporting success specifically in soccer. So how do you explain this?
I think that part of the reason, I guess, you know, I mean, soccer sort of becomes so tied to the nation in Uruguay. I'm certainly not the first person to say that. I don't think I'm really the first person to say anything in my book, quite honestly. But soccer is incredibly tied to the nation from this very early stage. It's in fact sort of the way that Uruguay presents itself and becomes known on the world stage. And so there's, I think, on one level, there's sort of this psychological or emotional tie between, you know, the nation and soccer. So, you know, there's a desire to perpetuate this sort of national pride. I think that's one side of it. I think the other side of it is really very practical. I mean, Uruguay went through a long period of decline. You know, you could sort of say the period from 50 to 70 was a long period of decline. 70 was this window where they finished fourth again. And then from 70 until, you know, really until 2010, there was this, again, this sort of 40-year decline. And I think that what happened is that, you know, I mean, among other things, Uruguay decided to invest pretty heavily and have a sustained program and have a plan and stick with it, right, to develop the youth. And this is really, it comes in with Oscar Washington Tabárez, right, that Uruguay is going to sort of put effort behind that. So they develop a really strong youth program starting in the 80s that sort of really begins to come to fruition. They have a couple solid youth tournaments in the 90s, and then comes to fruition in 2000. So I think it's a combination of sort of this, like, I mean, I don't want to say most kids in Uruguay, but there's a focus on soccer as Uruguay's sport, as such a part of Uruguayan identity, that then is coupled with this sort of more practical, more pragmatic desire to rebuild the program and a sort of effort on the part of the AUF to do that, a concerted effort on the part of the AUF, the Uruguayan Federation. That's what I would say. I mean, it's you know, I think that our sort of desire, our goals of putting too much on the emotional power or the national power of the sport, sometimes take us away from the fact that practically there has to be something put in place. There has to be a system put in place in order to build a team, particularly like Uruguay, which has, you know, again, as you've mentioned, a tiny population.
How about Javier Pescador?
Yes, I have a question. I wonder if you could comment on the long established idea that the Rio de la Plata was the birthplace of soccer, given the Uruguay international success in the first tournaments and also the long history of soccer in Argentina. So I'd like you to comment on that idea that has been around for quite a while, that soccer was born really in the Rio de la Plata, and I mean, soccer as we know it, of course, and not in Britain.
I think that's very much the case. I would sort of agree with that. It's something that I think soccer is born, I mean, right, the modern birthplace of the sport certainly is England, but, you know, it arrives in Argentina, you know, a scant sort of 5 years after the development of the sports right, or the development of the rules, and obviously the sport had been played for longer, and so I mean, I happen to think that really, you know, it's when Uruguay and when Argentina sort of go to Europe in 28, I mean, Uruguay in 24, but then Uruguay and Argentina in 28, that sort of opens Europeans' eyes to this style of game, this style of play, which is very different than what's being played in Europe. So I think that, you know, while it's born in England, I do think that the development of the sport is sort of contemporaneous in Latin America, and it develops in isolation with the European game. So there is a different style that's being played that has a major impact on Europe, starting in the 20s, maybe even earlier, when European teams sort of travel to Latin America. The other side of that, though, which I think is interesting, is that if you look at sort of the early writing on soccer from Uruguay, certainly, there's Carlos Sturzenegger writes in Carlos Sturzenegger writes in 1911 or 1912 about how really the Uruguayan style is being taught to them by a Scottish coach. So I think that, you know, there's sort of some play there. But that's my thought, I guess. Sorry for being so vague, but that's kind of my idea about it is that, yeah, I mean, as we know it, it's very much, you know, very much Rio de la Plata, and then, wait, is anyone else getting this crazy static, or is that just me? So it's, yeah, it's Rio de la Plata, and then ultimately, I think, you know, then Brazil takes that over to a certain extent.
That was Peter. I've unfortunately had to boot him from the call, but we'll get him back in when his microphone. No, Javier asked me to comment as well, so I'll add my two cents. I don't have the comparative lens fresh in my mind to answer whether this is true or not, but I think what is interesting to talk about that is fresh in my mind is the patterns of the modern game are there very quickly in the Rio de la Plata. In Buenos Aires, by the 1910s and 1920s, you have the patterns of club sports, of club soccer, that we see as typical of the 20th century experience. I mean, thinking of David Goldblatt's book, the large themes that he has in play throughout the history of the game, those patterns are not visible, but concrete in 1920s and 1910 and 1920s Buenos Aires. The tension between clubs as civic associations and as professional franchises, although it isn't professional yet, you know, certain players are certainly receiving jobs and money to play. The scale of thousands, tens of thousands of people in large stadiums, the first concrete being in 1928 in Buenos Aires, are there. The ties to neighborhood identities that we see, again, in the place that it's coming from, in Britain. But those, if it's not at the same time, and if it's not before in the Rio de la Plata, it's immediately after and independent of those patterns in Britain. So I think if we looked into it more, we could make a strong case that, you know, depending on what we call modern football, it is born in the Rio de la Plata, if not emerges at the same time there as well.
Yeah, I would say that's very well said.
I think someone was typing here. Who would like to ask the next question? Martha, go ahead.
I think I'm unmuted. So I have to admit, I unfortunately did not read the book beforehand, so I'm violating the first codes here. it's the life of an administrator, right? So, and a mom. But I'm curious about what you gained methodologically and theoretically from doing the project. Are you seeing different ways, like if you're advising students to do something like this? we're looking at many different countries. Partly, I mean, there's a way of doing research and, you know, archives, interviews, whatever. But I'm thinking more in terms of like themes and theories and things that you found emerging, and particularly in a comparative sense, differences between the different countries. And I'm asking that also because then I have this larger question is like, how different is this? And I know there's, you know, especially like based on the last question, even how different might these experiences be from what we would find, say, in the African context? And not because you can answer that question, but just theoretically and methodologically, what are the things that we might look for to say, okay, let's compare this, that. So that's my question.
Right. I mean, that's a great question, I certainly can't speak to the African context really at all. I guess. I mean, I think that the sort of broader comparative approach. I think one thing I would say is that the broader comparative approach is probably, I think, given sort of the approach that I took, it's too broad in one sense. So in one sense, my methodological take would be don't try to do seven countries at once. But sort of more specifically than that, I mean, I guess for me, the questions that the methodological question, the only methodological question that I sort of deal with really in the book is one of narrative construction and deconstruction, right? And so I think that's, to me, particularly as we look in our contemporary sports world, you know, the idea that there's sort of certain almost narrative truths about the sport or in general I think that it's always, I think that what I would say is that it's crucial to sort of always question those, right? To look back at the construction of these narratives and sort of not unpack them, but sort of undo them to see where they come from. So, you know, that to me was the main sort of, again, the main methodological thing that I was looking at. Sort of where is it that the construction of the nation via soccer comes from? What about it is artificial? What about it is you know, has some basis in you know, in fact, and sort of contextualizing that. So I think that to me is sort of crucial, is looking at that issue. And yeah, I mean, and I think sort of the biggest player, I think, in the construction of the narrative, right, is the media. And I've been sort of teaching this semester, and it's becoming clear. I don't know that it was as clear to me as I was writing the book, or maybe it was clear to me, but I didn't have enough time to put it in, that really the crucial player here, more than anything else, more than the sport itself, it is sort of media. You know, and Latin America takes the lead really in a lot of ways in sort of radio, in press coverage, and sort of linking the idea, you know, of a national psyche to soccer. So that, again, that's sort of a rambling answer to the question, but I think it is for me the thing that sort of that I would say for me is it is sort of narrative construction, deconstruction, and sort of, you know, the ability to use the sport as a counter narrative as well. I don't know if that answered your question at all. I'm sorry.
Yes, it's great.
How about Chris Brown next?
Thanks, Alex. Possibly linked to the previous answer, one of the big narratives we think about is, as you mentioned in the book, why soccer in most of Latin America and baseball in places like Venezuela. And one of the interludes in the book was precisely about Venezuela. And I came away from it remarking to myself that if you'd replace the word baseball with soccer in that short chapter, then we wouldn't have noticed that really the narrative that you lay out seems to be quite similar, the early development of baseball there and how it went through the 20th century. And so I was wondering, and I know this is a big topic, whether you consider there to be anything especially essentially different about soccer to baseball that allows soccer to be used in a national narrative in a different way to baseball, or as, at least from my reading, your short section on that suggests that they're really interchangeable, and it's all about the narratives that are constructed around them, no matter which team sport it is.
Yeah, that's a great question, Chris. I think so. The one way to answer that is that the Venezuela sort of interlude was originally going to be a chapter, and for a number of reasons, both time-wise, funding-wise, etc., that sort of it got chopped down to an interlude. I don't want to say that it's a one-for-one interchange that you could make. I think, you know, there are sort of national contextual differences between, you know, baseball in Venezuela and football in Argentina or Brazil, or why, you know, anywhere. But I think that for the most part, there is a certain interchangeability to them. And it's not only in the narrative, but it's also in the sort of the adoption of the sport by the elite, the sort of the arrival of similar context, right? The arrival of sort of leisure culture, the arrival of public education with physical education as a major factor, and the fact that you know, Venezuela adopts baseball instead of football is I mean, it matters obviously, but if soccer had arrived in Venezuela first, or if it had been popularized in Venezuela first, we could easily be talking about that. Similarly, you know, baseball in Mexico, you know, until the 1920s, you know, football wasn't the national sport in Mexico. There was really sort of a competition between baseball and football for that. But I do think that, you know, the general trends where baseball fits in Venezuelan history, in Venezuelan sort of identity construction, because it arrives at the same time, I think there's a very similar arc. It's not exactly interchangeable, but close. Let's put it that way.
Thanks, I appreciate that. Just a quick follow-up, and again, I'm from a position of ignorance, I'm wondering about the possible differences. In Venezuela and other places in the Caribbean, etc., mm-hmm. where baseball is predominant, has baseball been separated from its U.S. connection in the same way that soccer has been separated from its British Empire, for instance, connection?
To a large extent, yes. Yes. I mean, I think, you know, if you look, particularly if you take a look at Venezuela today or Cuba today, certainly, baseball is very much the national, you know, a national game that sort of allows for, to a certain extent, the same type of, you know, beating the United States in World Baseball Championships. So it doesn't have the same cachet, you know, as beating England early in the 20th century. But beating the United States does have a certain element of breaking ties. And certainly in Cuba, you know, baseball is at once sort of the way that Cubans define their sort of their nation against Spain. And then after the revolution, sort of becomes a continued way to sort of break with or prove some form of parity with the United States. And obviously Cuba has a major investment in sporting excellence in order to sort of prove or highlight the benefits of the Cuban system. And Venezuela has something of the same. I mean, Venezuela remains much more tied to the United States, you know, through the 80s, certainly. I mean, I think it was in 1987 or 1988, I was in Venezuela visiting my grandparents, and we were in a cab, and someone was like, "Oh, you're from New York." And I said, "Yeah, I'm from New York." And the guy was like, "Daryl Strawberry, he comes and plays in the Winter League every year." You know, it was like right around the time when Daryl Strawberry was huge. So there was still a lot of ties, but I think increasingly it is separated from the United States as well.
Thank you.
Yeah.
How about Andrew Guest?
I'm trying to unmute. Can you hear me?
You're good.
Yeah.
Okay. I've also got the noontime bells going off here, so apologize for the background noise. I was sort of curious. I wanted to go back to that piece about sort of narratives and grand narratives and counter narratives, which seem to be sort of a theme. And it struck me that some of what you were interested in the book is the counter narratives, and particularly things like, you know, the Honduras piece and the women's football piece. But you said in the introduction that you, you know, you were asked to do sort of a crossover, kind of half popular, half academic book. And I suspect that the academic folks are more interested in the kind of counter narratives, and the popular folks who are interested in selling books are more interested in the kind of the grand narratives. So I'm sort of curious about how that sort of played out, how that's kind of gone over, like what kind of reception you've gotten to the counter narratives. And along those lines, I mean, it's funny. I read some of your blogging around the World Cup about Honduras, and I just assumed you had sort of a background with Honduras. I thought probably your dissertation was about Honduras or something. So I was interested to hear that your dissertation was Cuba. But
yeah,
am I wrong that you seem particularly sort of fascinated by Honduras as a case, which is cool because, as you said, there's very little about it otherwise. But as sort of a tangent, I guess, to my broad question, I'm just sort of curious the particular fascinating. I mean, it is obviously a very interesting issue, just the way that the different kind of historical ethnic groups are integrated and presented in a public face there. But it's kind of a tangential question to the big question about the way the sort of favoring of the counter narratives plays out in the reception of it.
Yeah, no, thanks for that. And just really quickly to answer the aside, I mean, I think the reason that I was, you know, the Telegraph contacted me to write about Honduras going into the World Cup. I think because I might be the only person who's written about Honduran soccer in English. I mean, there's some great bloggers out there and some great sort of coverage of Honduran soccer in Spanish, but I don't think there was anything in English. So I think they saw that there was something written in English. They're like, hey, this guy should do it. But the broader question, I think, is in terms of the reception. I mean, for me, certainly, yes, you're right. The more interesting chapters to write, and to a large extent, the more challenging chapters to write were, and maybe that's where they are more interesting, but were the counter narrative chapters, right? The ones that sort of fly against the grain. In terms of reception, you know, I haven't gotten, there's been a lot of, I think I've gotten a lot of positive reception about the women and gender chapter, just because, you know, there's so little written about women and gender in soccer generally, and even really less about Latin America, at least in sort of a larger format. And also the Honduras, I mean, so for me in my, you know, in my small world in North Carolina, you know, both the Honduras chapter, the race chapter, and the gender chapter have been sort of much more, they've been well received. I don't think that in general, the narrative chapters, the ones that sort of hew to the more grand narrative style or a grand narrative theme, have been less well received. But especially since I think, you know, I try to sort of debunk some of those narratives as well. But yeah, I think that in general, you know, the Honduras chapter and the gender chapter, they're not, they're sort of, I mean, for me, they were the chapters where I was trying to say something different, trying to make an argument that really hadn't, or to discuss something that hadn't been discussed so much. I won't say that to make an argument that hadn't been made before, but to discuss something that hadn't been discussed. And I think that you could make the same, you know, people have asked me sort of about why Ecuadorian friends of mine are like, well, you didn't include Ecuador, or you know, obviously Colombia, Bolivia. You know, and my response, you know, to a large extent, it's like, if you look at the race chapter, if you look at the Honduras chapter, it's not, again, it wouldn't be a one-to-one sort of exchange in this, you know, like Venezuela, like baseball and soccer, it wouldn't be one-to-one. But with Ecuador, you could make the same argument about the Ecuadorian team. You could make the same argument about the Colombian team, you know, that it represents a pretty hidden face of the country to a large extent. And so that, to me, I think is, you know, I think it's generally been well received. I see your comment, Daniel. They didn't make the World Cup in 2010. That was the deal. They had to make the World Cup in 2010. But yeah. So sorry. But that's sort of the, again, a long-winded Andrew, a long-winded response to that question. Sorry.
No, that's good. Thanks.
I know Peter has a question. I'm not sure if he's able to ask it, though.
I'm having technical problems.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yep,
I got you.
Okay. Yeah, this Skype on iOS is giving me a bit of a headache. Sorry about this. It's hard to navigate the the various screens. I can't get to the chat function so easily, et cetera, et cetera. So let me ask the question while I'm successfully on the conversation. I want to circle back to Honduras in part because I thought that was one of the chapters that really stuck with me, Honduras, and also the section on Paraguay and Leos and the chapter on women's football. Those were the three that I think learned the most from. and about Honduras, the discussion of race and this odd situation whereby a country that has, what, you said 2% or thereabouts of the population that is Afro-Honduran is, you know, very, very generously represented in the national team. Mm-hmm. Is also something we see in other Latin American national squads. I think of Ecuador in particular is one that jumps to mind. And I think the Afro-Ecuadorian population is around, what, 5% also. Can you say something about kind of this perhaps maybe even a broader trend in Latin America of this overrepresentation of Afro-Latins and what it says about the connections between race and nation and these narratives that you go into in the book?
Yeah. Sorry. That's a great question. I mean, I think we could also look at, I don't know, the representation of the U.S. basketball team as well. I think Honduras, I think, you know, you could look at Afro-Honduras, you could look at Afro-Ecuador, you could look at Afro-Colombia. I think Colombia has a similar situation, though, you know, officially the Afro-Colombian population is around 10%. So, you know, the percentage creeps a little bit higher. But I think that there are a couple of things. I think that it ties into an opportunity to sort of, you know, what are the opportunities afforded to communities of color in Honduras, in Ecuador, in Colombia. You know, there tend to be communities that have less access to education, less access to opportunity in all forms, right? The employment rates tend to be lower. Health outcomes tend to be worse. All of this is part of it. I think also that it ties into one avenue, if you will, for many, in fact, sort of one avenue is through sports, right? And I say this with Honduras, that sort of the Afro-Hondurans are supposed to be seen, you know, they're sort of seen as potential as sort of athletes, as artists, right, as musicians, but they're not anywhere sort of in the public face, and I think that's it speaks to Afro-Hondurans and Afro-Ecuadorians, Afro-Latins sort of relation to the state more broadly, right? It speaks to, again, the lack of access that they have economically, the lack of access they have educationally, and sort of the avenues that are open for Afro-Latins to succeed ultimately, really were those of sports, of arts, right? Music, art, dance, sport. And I think this sort of ties back to these very sort of racist, racialized notions of people, right? Of all people, going back to the late 19th century, early 20th century, and then sort of an ongoing disenfranchisement of people of color.
Can I follow up again?
Sure,
I'm taking advantage of the fact that I have a decent connection.
Go for it, Peter.
Seconds. Can you tell me a little bit about your choices about for the vignettes that are interspersed in the book? Kind of how much what kind of a role you played versus what the publisher wanted, and why you chose the players that you did, and how you saw them fitting in the larger manuscript. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a great question. You mean the little sort of interludes with the player sidebars, if you will? For some chapters, they were easier than other chapters, I guess. You know, for the women's chapter, it seemed to make the most sense to include Marta, right? And then Claudina Vidal seemed also like a tremendous sort of, you know, particularly when thinking about the idea of sort of counter narrative and someone cutting against the grain. I really felt like she represented that to a large extent, and at the same time as representing sort of a longer view for women's soccer. For other players, it was sort of, you know, it was my choice. I had actually a number more of them at some point there. At one point, there were, you know, almost 30 vignettes that I sort of put together. I basically tried to put them in as a way to exemplify one theme or another. I don't think that they always worked, to be honest. But that was the rationale behind them, was that they would fit in one way, shape, or form with the broader theme of whatever chapter we were talking about. At the same time, you know, there was this desire on the part of the publisher to have sort of more contemporary ones that people would recognize. So, you know, a lot of the ones that got left out were sort of, you know, the more historical ones that were maybe a little more obscure.
We have a few newcomers to the call. Is there anyone who hasn't asked a question want to ask a question now? Follow-up questions are also welcome. I saw Matt starting to type. Go ahead, Matt.
Hello.
Loud and clear.
I'd like to ask sort of where you see the national narrative of Brazil going, especially after this most recent World Cup disaster. And like if any of how the history of that country, so much being about Jogo Bonito, is going to be able to kind of live through this disaster.
I'm laughing at Daniel's typing there. I think that Brazil is going to be okay. I think that the legacy, I don't think that the legacy on soccer is going to be all of that, that long lasting. I think, you know, what I would say should happen, if I were, you know, Brazilian and a football fan, in Brazil, I would want to get rid of the entire administration of the CBF, right? And sort of start from scratch, along the lines of Uruguay. You know, they need to have some form of sort of national program that Brazil really lacks. So I would hope, if I were Brazilian again, and this is actually something that a number of Brazilian friends of mine have said, is that, you know, what you would want is to have a sort of a cleaning house of the CBF, so you could have sort of new blood and the realization that Brazil can't get by on skill alone at this point. You know, what you've had instead, actually, you know, the whole Jogo Bonito, futebol arte versus futebol força, right? You've sort of had a doubling down on futebol força, because after the World Cup, who did they bring back to run the national team? Dunga. And Dunga is sort of the embodiment, really, of this sort of more tactical, more practical, more defensive style of play that you know, theoretically flies in the face of everything that Jogo Bonito stands for. I don't personally actually think that that's fully true. As a note, I think that Dunga actually gets unfairly criticized, largely because he has a horrible relationship with the media. But I guess, you know, so what we've seen is that, you know, the CBF is not really willing to change its internal functioning, that there's not going to be sort of an effort to develop, to really develop youth soccer in Brazil, in a sustained way that sort of creates a national program. I mean, but I think in terms of the national identity, I don't think that that's, you know, I don't think that that the Mineraço is going to sort of take away from Brazilian love of the game. I think if anything, right, if Brazil comes back and say, you know, wins the next World Cup, then it will be sort of seen as like a second Maracanã. It'll be remembered as sort of this loss that spurs us on to greater things, right? I can't remember, was it Ernst Renan who said that, you know, losses count more than national losses, national tragedies are more important in creating national identity than victories are. So I think you may well see if Brazil rises from the ashes that it's remembered sort of not exactly fondly, but as a wake up call, which I don't think it is. It has been, but it will be remembered as such.
Great. Who'd like to ask the next question?
Hi, can you hear me?
Go ahead, Marcus.
Actually, this is Ed.
Oh, Ed.
Yeah. Hi, this is Ed Murphy. I'm a history professor here at Michigan State.
Hi, Ed.
Thanks. I enjoyed reading your book a lot. And I kind of want to ask you an impossibly large question. So feel free to answer it piecemeal or just give a few thoughts on it. But so I'm a Latin American historian, and I have to admit that I don't have much background in sports history, although now that I'm here at Michigan State and with the Football Scholars Forum going on and a graduate student like Alex Galarza, who I'm working with, being very interested in these things, I'm following a little bit more closely. But I do want to, I was wondering a little bit as I was reading it, what does this do for... To switch this around a little bit and think about it more through the lens of Latin American history, mm-hmm. What does a general history of soccer and do to our overall understanding, and particularly of sort of national imaginaries in Latin America? It seems to me that one thing that you do is that, you know, of course, Benedict Anderson and then a whole bunch of others in Latin America and elsewhere were thinking about Creole pioneers and the specifics of nationalism very much in the independence era. Other people pick this up at different moments. It appears to me that the soccer does some very particular things, allows us to think about some very particular ways in which national imaginaries evolve in Latin America. In the first place, we have to put right on the table the interconnections between the evolution of nationalism and interconnections with the rest of the world, with British soccer. We also have to think very much about the kinds of transformations and interconnections that are happening in the late 19th century, early 20th century that allow soccer to become such a vibrant part of Latin America. It's also the case that you have this particular way in which popular culture is playing out through soccer and allows us to think a little bit more deeply then about the trajectory of national imaginaries via soccer. So those were just a few of the things that I was kind of thinking about as I was reading the book. And I guess I just wanted to hear your reaction, hear what you had to say a little bit about what you say to Latin American historians about how the story of soccer, a general story of soccer, what it has to tell us about, you know, the evolution of nationalism and imagined national communities in Latin America.
Yeah, that's a very broad question, but thanks. I mean, I think you've hit a number of them, right? I think it so for me, part of the idea, I guess, behind the book is that, you know, to understand, and I say this at some point, you know, to understand 20th century Latin America, you kind of have to understand soccer because, as you noted, right? Because it ties to the interconnections of, you know, of Latin America, between Latin America and Europe, both not only economically but culturally. It ties to and sort of intellectually. You know, it introduces sort of a way. I mean, I like to think of it as, you know, soccer sort of is a petri dish, a way that the soccer stadium is a petri dish, right? That, you know, sort of social issues can play out on the field in sort of a safe setting, right? So whether it's sort of the inclusion of the working class, the inclusion of Afro-Brazilians, the inclusion of, you know, sort of how we're going to function, how we're going to sort of deal with sort of increased women's participation in society, sort of all the main, a lot of the main questions, not all of them, a lot of the main questions that, that Latin America was sort of grappling with in the early 20th century and to a certain extent still continues to grapple with today, sort of play out on the soccer field. And I really think that that for me is what I would say is that, you know, when we want to understand, particularly when it comes to sort of popular culture, you know, when we want to understand how, you know, I mean, I don't want to overdraw this, right? But when we want to understand how Argentines or how Uruguayans thought of their nation, right? I mean, you know, how do you do that? How do you access that? And one place to access that is looking at the popularity of soccer, and one place to access sort of these larger social discussions, debates, is through looking at what happens on the soccer field and what reactions to what's happening on the soccer field are. So I guess that's my thought on that.
You know. No, great, thank you. And my apologies for the impossibly broad question.
No,
if I could, if I could ask a much more specific question, if people don't mind. I'm sorry, I jumped in a little late on the call, so maybe you already answered this a little bit. But I was curious, I heard somebody allude to the fact that the press had wanted you to bridge in some ways an academic audience and a popular audience. And I imagine that was kind of what you were thinking of as you were writing it. But I actually was really curious just about how was your book actually reviewed by the press? You know, how did they send it out to external reviewers, and what kinds of expectations did they have? Because, right, you know, as you know, writing for an academic press with academic audiences often has particular kinds of review processes that, sure, lead to, you know, particular expectations about whatever, certain, yep, number of footnotes, archival sources, in addition to, you know, a certain kind of historiographies that you get into. But clearly you were able to, you didn't have to worry about that as much with this book. So I was just curious a little bit, what was the review process like and how you negotiated that as you were moving forward with writing the book and presenting it to the press and all that?
Yeah, sure. So actually, I mean, the book was sent out, you know, it was reviewed by two academics who write about soccer or who write about sport in Latin America. I don't know exactly who they were. I have my ideas of who they were, but I'm pretty sure I know who they
are. Maybe they're on this call.
I don't think they're on the call. And they were great. The reviewers were great. I will say that just in case they're on the call, but I'm pretty sure they're not. So what the press did was actually, it has sort of its own, you know, it's got a sort of a trade volume questionnaire that it sends out, right? So I imagine that it's quite similar, you know, it was basically, I mean, it was an anonymous peer review process with the knowledge that this is sort of, you know, it is meant for a trade audience. So I think they have a different questionnaire for an academic, a book that's straight academic and a book that's more oriented towards a trade audience. I mean, so, you know, it was sent out. There was some pretty strong and valid suggestions for changes to make to it. So, you know, it was sent out, and then it was basically, I was given like a revise and resubmit kind of thing. And so did that, and then it was sent to the reviewers again, and they approved it the second time. So, I mean, I think, you know, there were different expectations, you're right, in terms of footnotes, in terms of historiography, all of that, but it was still a pretty rigorous process. I would say it was a pretty rigorous process anyway. You know, it maybe wasn't as rigorous as others, but it was pretty intense.
No, well, thank you very much. I only asked that because I just recently dealing with my own manuscript. I felt like I was pushed to be more academic, much that I didn't want to be, but that was sort of the way in which I got pushed. So anyway, well, thank you very much. I appreciated reading the book. Very much enjoyed it.
No, thank you. And I will say that you know, there were one of the reviewers pushed it to be more academic. And I incorporated those to the extent that I felt like it could still be sort of true to the goals of being sort of in between trade and press. Trade and academic. I had a little bit of leeway. Eventually sort of wrote a response letter saying, this is why I didn't make these changes, because I think it would sort of take it down a road that would lose a readership at some level. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
How about Melissa Forbes has a follow-up probably on the question of Latin American history, I'd imagine.
And what did Carlos Slim have to do today?
My internet is intermittent, and because he owns everything related to it, there's no one cares. No one wants to do anything to help you because they don't have to. So, sorry for showing up late. Actually, had a question related to that last one, but before the book question about the press, which is, I don't know if you've been following the John Bolsejour case in Chile and how he's really come forward claiming his Mapuche identity and talked about supporting the Mapuche struggle even as he plays for the Chilean national team. I don't know if you've been following that, but I wonder if you have, what thoughts you have on that in terms of this whole question of forming national identity in Latin America.
Sure. I haven't been following it at all, actually. What interests me about Bolsejour, I aside from the fact that he's, I think, at times a great player, is his Haitian heritage. So I was not aware of sort of the Mapuche. Do you want to, can you speak on that a little bit more? I'd love to hear more about it.
Just briefly, his mother is Mapuche, and he's come out in a lot of the very progressive and pro-Mapuche struggle press is talking about, claiming his identity, being for the struggle, supporting what they're doing. He wants a Mapuche team, is hoping to pull together a Mapuche team that would span traditional sort of ancestral Mapuche territory in Argentina and Chile. So it's kind of to the past maybe 6 months since the World Cup has been developing. So it's maybe something to watch, I think.
Yeah, no, that sounds fascinating. I will definitely. And thanks to Alex just put a link up to something. I would love to read more about it. I wish I could comment on it. Let's put it that way. And then did you say you had another question about sort of the press stuff?
Just about that. But I just wanted to say, yeah, congratulations on the book. It's super interesting. So, and sorry I came late.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Would anyone else like to ask a question? I think actually Chris Brown wanted to take us in a different direction. So go ahead, Chris.
Okay, thanks, Alex.
Yeah.
So going back to the women's soccer chapter,
yeah.
And I was thinking to myself, if I hadn't looked at the contents beforehand, the only reference that I picked up on, big reference I noticed, was when you noted how many goals Pelé scored, how he was only trailing to Mia Hamm, which then at the time she was the top women's international scorer. Mm-hmm. And I wondered whether that was a very deliberate decision to, in that particular moment, integrate in some way international soccer on the men's and the women's side. But more broadly, was there ever a moment, and I know this is your next project, right? Mm-hmm. But maybe you could give us a preview on that. Was there ever a moment where you could imagine integrating all the chapters?
Wow. So to answer the first question, yes. I mean, it was a very conscious decision to sort of put that in there because often, right, he's said to have scored the most goals, whatever. Just like I believe, there's this pretty recent kerfuffle when the U.S. said that Landon Donovan would retire as the leading goal scorer of the U.S. national team. Not true, right? At any rate, so there was definitely that was definitely a conscious decision on my part. As far as the second part, the stuff on women's soccer, there's sort of this theoretical section that I left out of it, largely in the interest of, well, there's a theoretical section that I left out of it. It was sort of half formed. It was, you know, a half baked idea in a lot of ways. You know, but finding stuff on women's soccer is incredibly difficult. So I guess a short answer would be no, I didn't think about sort of integrating, you know, mainstreaming women's soccer into the whole book. I think that maybe there is a day when that can happen, but there's got to be a lot of sort of archaeological work done on women's soccer in the region before that happens. You know, it's both incredibly exciting and incredibly frustrating for me to work on women's soccer, because, you know, you get these sort of moments of effervescence where there's, you know, for whatever reason or not, or for whatever reason, there's intense coverage of it, or there's interest in women's soccer, or, you know, and then it's gone. And then maybe there'll be like a 20-year period where there's one mention of women's soccer, right? And so it really is this sort of this slow, painful sort of sifting through the sands of sports literature, right? And it's really difficult to find. So I guess I don't see this is a long way of saying, you know, maybe we will be at that point, but we're not at that point yet, where we could sort of write a history of soccer in Latin America that sort of mainstreams women's soccer throughout. You know, there are other ways to do it, and I think I probably could have done a little bit more of this. But you know, there's a pretty intense, you know, in the 1910s, 1920s, and I'm sure others could speak to this as well. You know, there were a lot of women fans in the stadiums. It's sort of later. You know, and the timeline might shift from place to place, but in the sort of 40s and 50s and 60s, that sort of women sort of retire from the stadium, if you will, or women sort of leave the stadiums in large numbers. Maybe it's even later. It could be, you know, if you look at sort of the 50 World Cup, there's certainly anecdotally there were lots of women in the Maracana on the day of the finals, and you know, there's this sort of retreat is really the wrong word, but there's this moment at which women sort of go to the stadium less and less. So I think that, you know, this is an auto-criticism that I probably could have incorporated women's activities in soccer, if not their playing, more throughout the book. But actually women's soccer per se, you know, we're not at the stage yet. Brenda and I, as Chris knows, Brenda and I Brenda Elsie and I are beginning work now on a book on women's soccer. In the region, and we're working together on that, and it's really I think pretty exciting to be doing it, quite honestly. Not just because I get to work with Brenda, but also because, you know, it's sorely lacking in terms of what's out there, right?
Thanks for the answer. Thanks.
Yeah.
Would like to go next as we approach the 70th minute we're in.
Can I add my two cents, Alex?
Go for it, of course.
Building on the women's football chapter and the discussion, I think it's on, what, page 232, you, Josh, come out fairly clear on the idea that the nation is a masculine construct, particularly in the context of sports, and you know, that that women who try through football to represent their nation, or even just play the game, are transgressing, you say, traditional roles. You know, women are marginalized, stigmatized, and so on. Do you see this changing at all in recent years? I mean, we've got, what, four Latin American teams in playing in the 2015 World Cup. I think Ecuador, Colombia, Brazil, and Costa Rica, if I'm not mistaken. Is the game growing? Are political leaders and maybe here the center left with this fairly strong rise in Latin America of the sort of anti-American, if you want to put it crudely, front gaining ground, some other progressive changes? Do you see the nation as it is represented in football opening up to women's contributions, whether it's for media interest, consumeristic, or you know, other reasons, or do you see it continuing towards this, you know, reproducing these old patriarchal trends?
That's a great question. I think it's sort of it's not an either or. I think it's sort of it's still both. Yes, I mean, in a number of countries, sort of the opportunities for soccer and the reality of sort of women's soccer are becoming sort of much more regularized, normalized. Mexico, the Mexican national team has, I believe they were, you know, they've got a budget of like $2 million or $3 million this year. I mean, it's a pretty huge budget. You know, Costa Rica qualified for the first time to go to the World Cup. Ecuador qualified for the first time to go to the World Cup. Copa America, the women's Copa America, was much more competitive than it usually than it has been in the past. There were a number of teams. Colombia actually didn't qualify, but they had an opportunity to up until the last minute. Chile also has been investing pretty heavily in women's soccer. Brazil, I know I said before, I sort of lambasted the Brazilian Soccer Federation for not investing sort of systematically in men's soccer. They have been really bad about investing in women's soccer generally, but this year, and this goes, you know, back to the 2011 World Cup, where they actually didn't really practice beforehand, and they showed up in Germany 6 days before the cup, or something, 6 days or 7 days before the cup, and you know, you could see that they were out of shape when they played the United States, and the game went into overtime. They're now having a regular training camp. They're setting up a women's soccer program in a way that hasn't been done before in Brazil. So there are sort of these positive signs that that women's soccer is becoming much more accepted. And the media is doing its part. In Mexico, they're running sort of these short, you know, 3-minute clips about players from the Mexican women's team on some channels. I'm not sure if they're still doing that. They were doing that about a year ago. So there's sort of that side, which is, I think, positive and shows that women's soccer is gaining more acceptance. The other side of that is, you know, the Copa America Femenil, which is the World Cup qualifier, or Femenino, which is the World Cup qualifier, was the broadcast rights were free. And nobody picked up the tournament until the second or third day of the tournament because they didn't think that they would be able to find an audience for it. So I think there are still a number of sort of barriers, let's say, that, to sort of women's soccer becoming more accepted. And I think that some of those barriers that exist are still sort of the very gendered ideas that, you know, women shouldn't be playing soccer. I think there's still enough of a percentage of the population that thinks that, you know, there's still a pretty big impediment to the women's game.
Thank you.
So it's both. Yeah.
I'm currently waiting for a typed question from Ali, but we probably have time for a couple more. Anyone else? Go ahead, Chris.
Thanks. Yeah, just a quick question, Josh.
Yeah.
The book is about narratives and how people talk about the game. And I was interested in a couple of occasions you sort of described your own experience watching a game in a bar in Buenos Aires or wherever. And did it weigh heavily on you that your own description of the game? This is always something I wonder for myself, because I always seem to have a very different interpretation of games, especially 0-0 draws, which I tend to enjoy the most other people. And I just wondered, did you have to think a lot about your perspective, where you were coming from, as you were assessing these games you were watching?
Yeah, I think I did. I mean, you know, and I am, as I mentioned sort of at the outset, right, I'm not a soccer. I was not, let's put it this way. And tactically, no, I'll say it this way. Tactically, I'm not a soccer expert, right? I love the game. I understand the game somewhat, but I gained a good deal of understanding of the game through the process of writing this book, as opposed to sort of understanding the game and then coming to this book. So I think definitely the way that I, you know, the type of game that I like to watch, the type of style of play that I like to see, that definitely played into the way that I described things, and into the way that I sort of interpreted things. Yes, definitely. Although, you know, that said, I tend to, you know, again, I tend to be a little bit sanguine about others' interpretations of, you know, the Jogo Bonito or Futebol Arte or all of that. I think it's sort of a lot of that is in the eye of the beholder. I guess maybe I'm not sanguine about it. I think it is all, a lot of it is in the eye of the beholder.
Great. I'm going to ask a question on behalf of Alejandro González, who's in East Lansing. But he asked if you could elaborate a little bit on the chapter about Mexico. And now that more women are playing, what were the problems to get closer to the narrative of the women themselves? During the research itself, and what kinds of sources and if anything came from the press were used or what could you wish you have used if they didn't exist?
Oh, so for the Mexico chapter broadly, or for the sort of Mexico section on women's soccer?
I believe for the Mexico section on women's soccer. But if you want to talk about anything in the chapter in Mexico too.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one thing I wish I had with Mexico is the records of the Mexican Soccer Federation. The records of the Mexican Soccer Federation were destroyed in a fire, I think in the 1980s, maybe in the early 1990s. So, like, that entire sort of history of Mexican soccer is gone. So that's, I think that's one thing that I wish I had. When I was doing that chapter, so, you know, I've reached out to a number of, for the section on Mexican women's soccer, I would like to have had more of the players from the 70, or any of the players from the generation of 1970, from that sort of Women's World Championship 70-71 team to talk to. I did have sort of the guy who was the head of delegation when Mexico went to Italy in 1970. He and I are in pretty regular Facebook contact. And so he's been a great source of information. But I do wish that there had been sort of more, you know, and I've reached out to a couple of the women who played on that team. And they tend to be sort of, or so far anyway, they've been pretty reticent to talk about it at all. I think, you know, they sort of, you know, they got, they were sort of, I guess, ill-treated, it would be the way that they kind of got burned, I think, in their, you know, in in their treatment after 1971, because sort of women's soccer did have this huge growth in the late 60s and early 70s. And after the Women's World Championship, you know, basically the story is that the Mexican Soccer Federation and Cañedo, Televisa made a ton of money off of the Women's World Championship, both through ticket sales and through television rights. And the women, none of it went to the women because they were amateurs. And they were holding to this, the Mexican Federation sort of held to this amateur line, and said, we're not going to pay anybody. So, you know, and so the women actually who played and who sacrificed quite a bit, you know, it sort of goes back to early 20th century amateurism. They really got nothing for it. And then as soon as sort of the craze for women's soccer wore out or burned out, they were sort of left high and dry. Right? They'd sort of sacrificed years of their lives for this team, and then sort of abandoned. And so I think a lot of them have this, or at least this is my sense, and this is what some other people that I've talked to have said, is that they really feel like they don't necessarily want to talk about it because it still sort of burns them. And so that's what I wish I had when I was writing that chapter, is sort of more insight to them. And you know, it's something that I'm still working on. I'm sort of trying to go backwards through the generation. So I'm now sort of talking to the generation of the 90s, and hoping that through conversations with them, I can sort of, you know, that the women of the 1969, 70, 71 will sort of be more willing to chat with me about that.
I'd like to be selfish and ask the final question, so I'll ask if anyone has one before I chime in. That way we can get you to your 4 o'clock class on time.
Oh, it's all right. They can wait. It's grad class, and we're talking about Roger's book today. So, you know,
just Roger's book.
just the country of football.
Well, speaking of. Daniel, you want to chime in? I see some typing. No.
No.
Speaking of Roger's book here and who's on this call that studies soccer in Latin America, you know, this book, like all books, was a decision of the time they could invest, the sources that were available, when and where you could travel, and of course the press and the audience, as we've already discussed in the call, but you know, if a pile of money dropped from the sky and you were able to assemble a research team, I'm thinking of Laurent Dubois' review article now, almost 10 years ago, about where the state of the field was in soccer in Latin America. And we have, you know, a broad chunk of Latin America covered in David Goldblatt's book, and you've made a great contribution, especially on the question of narratives and national identity. Where do you think we can guess this on some of the vignettes and some of the interlude chapters? But where do you think the gaps are right now that need to be covered? And if not gaps, where would you want to go with a team of researchers to ask broad questions and answer those questions in a variety of mediums, of blogs or books? This is kind of a dream question, right? Where would you devote your energy after writing this book, you know, with the experience of the book fresh in your mind?
That's just such a small question.
That's why I saved it for last. And you can answer it quickly and call it silly.
Yeah. Wow. So a couple things jump to mind. I think, you know, it's not particularly sexy, but I think that, you know, I think that we don't really, I think there needs to be a lot of institutional research, right? That would be one thing. The institutions, you know, whether the federations themselves, and really some questioning about the federations, but also the confederation, right? What is CONMEBOL? How did that come about? How does that sort of dictate the reality of soccer, or does it? that would be one thing. Again, it's not particularly sexy, but I think it's important to think about sort of the institutional structures that govern the sport in the region in a more critical way. You know, obviously we can talk about Grondona, or we could talk about Teixeira, we could talk about Laos, and
yeah,
and
plenty of sexy topics there.
And talking about them would be, in a lot of ways, talking about the institution and the problems with the institutionalization of or not the problems, but the challenges of institutionalization and the sort of power structures within Latin American soccer. So that's one. I mean, obviously, you know, I'm beginning a topic on women's soccer, so I would say that's a huge gap, right? A huge gap. But I think also, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's been written about club soccer in Latin America, but a lot of it is sort of club hagiography. And so I think that, you know, there needs to be a much more critical examination. And I think there are a lot of, I mean, I think, you know, you're doing it with Boca. I think that there's a much more critical examination of these going on, or it's part of what you're doing with Boca, right? But I mean, I think this is, I think that also needs to be done, right? So institutions, you know, and with institutions, you could say links between government and soccer, right? What is, you know, I think there's certainly more that can be done there. And women's soccer and just about everything else. And I think the literature is quite rich, but I think what's lacking in a lot of, I think not what's lacking, but what there could be more of is more sort of critical analysis of clubs, of institutions, of leagues. That would be it.
No, that's a fantastic answer to an unfair question. So,
not an unfair question at all.
Great. Well, if no one else has any questions, I'll leave a second here to ask. We can thank everyone for their time, and again to Josh for his book and for his time.
Thank you all. It's been really great. Thanks for everything.